stock turmoil in China again today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Another stock sell-off in China creates global jitters.
The Chinese stock market is actually, if you want to understand what it is, you pretty much all you need to do is to walk into a casino.
That's not so comforting. Also, a year later, still trying to make sense of the attack on French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo.
I'm trying to recapture the visceral reactions that I think I felt and everybody felt at the idea of cartoonists being murdered for having drawn a picture.
Plus, advice for those about to be deported back to Central America.
When I talk to families, I tell them, when you leave here, you will leave here basically with only what's on your back.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Paris lived through another tense 24 hours today, exactly 1 year since the Charlie Hebdo massacre last January. Today, a man armed with a meat cleaver tried to run into a police station. He was wearing what was thought to be an explosive suicide belt. An officer shot him dead. The suicide belt turned out to be fake, but prosecutors have still opened a terrorism investigation. Paris remains under a state of emergency after the November terrorist attacks, which left 130 people dead. But Paris has felt the tension for a year now since the cartoonists at the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo were killed. Last January, one of the people I spoke with on The World was Françoise Mouly. She's the art editor at The New Yorker, and she told us about the magazine's special cover back then. It paid homage to the murdered Charlie Hebdo cartoonist. Maybe you remember it. It showed the Eiffel Tower rising from a blood-red fog, its top replaced with a red pencil tip. Françoise Mouly joins me again. Françoise Mouly, what occurs to you on this first anniversary of the attacks at Charlie Hebdo? What are you feeling?
I'm trying to recapture the visceral reactions that I think I felt and everybody felt at the idea of cartoonists being murdered for having drawn a picture. Because afterwards came a lot of rationalization, but maybe because I deal in images, I'm more interested in visceral reactions and in rationalizations.
Talk a bit about the sense of solidarity in France that resulted from those attacks a year ago, and what's become of that solidarity in the last 12 months, in your view?
At the time that it happened, everybody went out in the street and felt unified in a denunciation of the murders. Then came a lot of talk and back and forth, including, you know, people who pointed out that everybody was out in the street, but maybe not too many people of Arab descent, that it was not truly unified, that it didn't represent every ethnic group and every social class. And that may be true, but there still was a sense of revulsion at the thought of an attack on cartoonists, on journalists, on people whose raison d'être is creativity and mocking not so much religion, but mocking the use of religion for political ends. And then since then, there's been a lot of debates and there's been controversies about the legacy of Charlie Hebdo. It wasn't at the forefront. It wasn't known internationally. Now it is, for all the wrong reasons.
I'm really curious. Do you think cartoonists have become more determined in their fight against extremism, or have they recoiled and censored themselves in a way?
Both are true. There is a sense that cartoonists have a mandate and have a mission, and many cartoonists felt recommitted to their calling by, in a way, seeing the importance given to cartoonists in this attack. It's a tragic way to find out how much cartoons matter. But yes, I think they feel they are at the avant-garde of having to keep this freedom of mocking, of if cartoonists become complacent, and if cartoonists are fearful, then that's a very bad sign. Since their avowed mission is to mock, if they stay away from any topics, then who will actually take on, you know, the terrorists? It's giving them exactly what they're trying to provoke.
Françoise, you said earlier that after the attacks, Charlie Hebdo became known worldwide for all the wrong reasons. Tell us how Charlie Hebdo should be known by the world.
Well, I'd like it to be acknowledged for the courage that those cartoonists had in going to an editorial meeting, even though they had received death threat, because, of course, you know, in this day and age, you can always fax things and you can email them. And to actually get together in a room and discuss ideas is something worth celebrating. And also for historically, the May 68 movement and the generation that I am from, Charlie Hebdo was very important because they were taking on De Gaulle and the political system at the time, as well as the clergy. And the fact that something from that counter-culture movement would still be alive, it's important that it leaves a positive legacy.
Françoise Mouly, art editor at The New Yorker. She also edits and publishes Toon Books, which are hardcover comic books for early readers. Françoise, thank you very much.
Thank you. Very honored to be here.
The Charlie Hebdo attacks rattled Paris and, to a lesser extent, the provinces of France. We wanted to go even further afield to a place that for France is like Hawaii is for us, Réunion or Reunion. It's in the tropics, and yet it's still very French. Reporter Emma Jacobs was in Reunion last year as NPR's John Alexander Project Fellow, and she says events back in France proper, including last year's terrorist attacks, always have an impact on the island.
They're followed very closely. I mean, one of the interesting things about Reunion and the way the news works there is you get the weather in the Alps or in Paris at the top of the hour on the newscast. There is this way in which just the news cycle is really one in the same. And so they were very upset just after Charlie Hebdo last year was what people were talking about. There were Je suis Charlie signs in bars in Reunion.
I mean, Reunion is a melting pot, I guess we can say. It's in that neighborhood of sub-Saharan Africa, India, the Arabian Gulf, Madagascar. How does that play into how people in Reunion see what's happening back in France?
They really have a history of being a very diverse place that is much older than France. And I think they have this sense that they have worked out issues that metropolitan France has not.
Does that make, you think, Reunion kind of naturally tolerant as opposed to the state-sanctioned secularism of Paris?
I mean, I think it helps. I think it makes things less bipolar, as do a lot of this, the sort of historical facts about the island. I mean, it's not just that there is a population that is the descendants of slaves and the descendants of slave owners. There are a lot of different Indian indentured servants or a Chinese immigrant population that's arrived. It's just a complicated picture. There has been a lot of intermarriage over centuries. And so it's become a place where people have a lot of ties. It's a less polarized place, I think, because of the extent of the diversity.
I mean, it sounds the way you describe it kind of like a harmonious place, a harmonious version of Paris, perhaps. Are there holes in it? I mean, where would you point to kind of like the fault lines in Reunion?
There's a tremendous amount of unemployment on the island. And to some extent, that does seem to follow racial lines. It does seem to be the case from what limited research has been possible, given that you can't collect racial statistics in France.
That's the law. It's kind of like a anti-quota system.
Exactly.
Almost, right?
Yeah. It's a sort of like Stephen Colbert, we don't see race, and that helps us to get along, right? But, you know, the economic realities do seem to follow racial lines.
So if we can call that the fault line in the system, let's put that aside. When you see the problems Paris and France have with diversity, could Reunion be a model they could use? Do they even think about it?
I think they do think about it. And I think they would hope to be. I think what is so interesting, but is what is also so difficult to export is they have the diversity with a very different history, right? Reunion has just been so diverse from the beginning and has had so many years to work this out. There's this historical specificity to it that makes it hard to say. But I think they absolutely feel, you know, particularly on a religious front as well as an issue of racial diversity, that they have figured something out that they think they could teach the metropole.
Reporter Emma Jacobs in Paris, she's been telling me how tensions in Paris play out in the French Indian Ocean territory of Reunion. Emma, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Okay, our next story is about this weird fascination some people have in South Africa for Native American culture. It's actually pretty easy to find stereotypical portrayals of American natives in South Africa. There's even a popular restaurant chain there called Spur Steak Ranches, where the decor is all teepees and totem poles, and costume characters named Soaring Eagle and Buffalo Brave stop by your table. Erin Conway Smith, with her partners at Global Post, went to one location to see for herself.
Well, the first thing you see when you approach the restaurant is the logo, which is a Native American chief in a headdress, sort of looming over the entrance of the restaurant. As for what's on the menu, kind of like steaks, burgers, you can get chicken schnitzel, nachos, pretty kind of general fare. But it's a really popular restaurant with families here.
When you first arrived in South Africa and saw the big sign at a Spur restaurant, what was your reaction?
I felt pretty confused. It was like, I don't understand what Native Americans have to do with the steak restaurant. That was sort of my reaction.
You spoke with the head of the Spur chain, and he said something that I found kind of weird, that they actually changed the theme from kind of grosso modo Western to more Native American with the kind of the collapse of apartheid.
Yeah, what he was saying is that they did it to signify to South Africans of all races that they're welcome at this restaurant. And that's what he said. He described it as, you know, by having a man of color on the logo, that would therefore set a signal that the restaurants are open to all.
Does anyone make the connection? Do black South Africans make the connection between apartheid and the way North American natives were treated?
Not really. They don't seem to really understand why this is a problem. Perhaps it's because there's so little sort of contact with Native American culture here in South Africa. So a lot of the impressions people have would come from like Hollywood movies and depictions of Native Americans in Hollywood films, that sort of thing.
Right.
So I think that there's just a real lack of awareness. I mean, I was on a local talk radio show the other day and had people calling in and nobody, black and white people that called in, seemed to see what the problem was. A lot of people seem to think it's like a kind of a tribute almost. You know, they're paying homage to Native American culture and they don't seem to really quite get the fact that this is, you know, these are stereotypes, unwanted stereotypes at that. Like I've been pretty surprised by some of the comments I've had, even from really educated people that just don't have any awareness about Native American culture, you know, why this might be a problem.
I mean, there must be some South Africans who reject these portrayals. Is there any desire or anyone you know of who's seeking out kind of a more authentic narrative of indigenous North Americans? Like, do you know anybody who in South Africa who reads the novels of Sherman Alexie, for example?
Oh, no. I've not heard of anybody doing that. I've seen a couple of comments on Twitter that do suggest that there are people that are aware, but it's in the minority, vast minority.
Now, you spoke with a member of the Choctaw tribe. Was she in South Africa, went to Spur? How did you connect?
I contacted her because she's involved with a campaign in the U.S. Around changing sports mascots that have Native American portrayals in them. And so I was curious to hear what she thought. So she hasn't been to a Spur. She hasn't been to South Africa, but she spent quite a bit of time looking through the Spurs, their extensive website and checking out some of the imagery, and was pretty shocked by it. And I think South Africa is, you know, very far away from it all. I think that's probably part of the problem, that South Africa is so disconnected. There is a complete lack of understanding about these issues here.
Erin Conway Smith with our partners at Global Post. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Coming up, tips on how to prepare for deportation. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. 2016 has gotten off to a nerve-wracking start for many undocumented migrants here in the U.S. The Obama administration began the year with a new round of deportation raids. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents have been going to the homes of Central American immigrants in states including Texas, Georgia, and South Carolina, and rounding up the undocumented people. About 120 people have been deported so far, many of them women and children. The raids are part of the Obama administration's efforts to discourage families and unaccompanied children from crossing the border illegally. But those efforts are failing, says Sonia Nazario. She's the author of Enrique's Journey, the story of a boy's dangerous odyssey to reunite with his mother.
the administration pushed Mexico and funded Mexico with tens of millions of dollars to interdict these folks and keep them from arriving at the United States. But now the smugglers are finding ways around those new barriers, and they're finding new routes. People are paying smugglers more, and Mexico has become more ambivalent about doing the U.S.'s dirty work. So the numbers, the situation has not improved in Central America. It's as violent as ever. People are desperate to get out, and they're finding the way to the United States. And out of political expediency here in the electoral season, the presidential season, this administration does not want to see chaos at the border. So they're cracking down.
Does this surprise you? Because the White House, I thought, was trying to make progress on immigration. Is deportation a solution or even a precursor to real reform?
I think this administration has botched from the beginning its handling of Central Americans. El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras have some of the highest homicide rates in the world, second only in kill rate to Syria. And so the situations, the desperation many people are fleeing is go or die. I was in Mexico in the fall. I talked to mothers who had been grabbed by gangs and forced to view someone being dismembered alive and being told, this is what will happen to you by gangsters and narco cartels if you aren't my girlfriend starting tomorrow. No amount of deportation will deter someone who is facing that kind of situation. Those people will flee, and deporting 120 or deporting thousands of people will not change that equation.
So the U.S. had relied heavily on Mexico to slow down the influx, but Mexico has decided for various reasons to slow down its crackdown on migrants traveling through the country. Why, if U.S. tax dollars are supposed to be helping them out?
The U.S. has given tens of millions of dollars to Mexico to engage in this ferocious crackdown that I witnessed last year in Mexico. It's virtually impossible to ride on top of freight trains now to reach the United States. The officials are tasering people off of moving freight trains.
They've Mexican officials are doing that.
Mexican officials, yeah. That's right. And they are actually deporting Mexico far more Central Americans now than the United States. This has been a real shift. But I think Mexico felt that those tens of millions of dollars were not worth the criticism that they were getting for doing the dirty work of the United States of halting these Central Americans from arriving at the United States. And by the way, in Mexico, there is virtually no way to claim asylum. Only 18 children in 2014 were granted asylum, Central American children in Mexico. So many of these people really don't have any due process at all in Mexico and are being sent back to places where they have been threatened once, twice, three times. I interviewed a woman at a migrant shelter in southern Mexico last fall. You know, she had had her brother killed by the gangs. They had cut off his feet and hands in Honduras. Oh, then her 14-year-old son had been told by the gang once, you're going to join us or we'll kill you. And they suffocated him to death. She ran to another city 3 hours away. And in 7 months, the gangs found her. The gangs are better than the CIA at intelligence in these countries in tracking the movement of people. And within 24 hours of being told the gangs have found you again, she fled with her remaining 3 children. That mother will do anything to get out of that situation and save her remaining 3 children.
Journalist Sonia Nazario is the author of Enrique's Journey. She's also on the board of Kids in Need of Defense, a group that recruits pro bono attorneys for unaccompanied immigrant children. Sonia, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
When I talk to families, I tell them, first and foremost, when you leave here, you will leave here basically with only what's on your back.
That's the bottom line. Susan Cruz lays out to families who are worried about deportation. Cruz was born in El Salvador and founded Sin Fronteras. That's a nonprofit that helps young immigrants in conflict with the law. She says deportation is a topic most undocumented families will do anything to avoid discussing.
It's like talking to your elderly parents about leaving a will and what's going to happen in case they are not capable of making decisions for themselves. Nobody wants to touch these issues.
Yeah, so what's it like when you have to, as an advisor, open up these issues with them and start talking about them?
Oftentimes when I tell them that their children may end up in foster care and how it will be the decision of a family court judge as to where they'll go and who they will live with, that often gets the conversation going. Them imagining the worst possible case scenario, like losing their parental rights and their children being adopted by strangers, often will get them thinking that maybe it's time to have a conversation.
Well, I don't know if it's the worst case scenario, but a bad case scenario you encountered a few years ago, a family in Los Angeles, the oldest child came home and mom and dad were not there. Tell us about that and what happened to the kids.
Yes. So there was a raid in a factory in Van Nuys, and it was over 150 people that were detained in this immigration raid. And we received notice that a group of children who had been living in the apartment, the eldest of them was taking care of them. He didn't know what had happened to their mother. He stepped into her shoes and assumed responsibility for his younger siblings, making sure that they continued going to school until, of course, the next month started and the landlord came looking for the rent. And that's when the landlord called Child Protective Services and the children were taken in and separated into different foster homes while the mother's situation was resolved, which unfortunately ended up in deportation.
I mean, practically speaking, how can you prepare for deportation? I mean, do you keep a bag packed? And when you hear that ICE is coming down the street, quick, grab the bag and a toothbrush and the kids, and where do you go?
That's actually something, you know, that I would not recommend. The three things I tell them is find someone you trust that you can say, this person will make decisions for me in case I am not able to. Once that person has been identified, my next piece of advice is put it in writing. I have found that it takes a long time for social workers to identify a person that they can talk to, a person that the children feel comfortable with. My next piece of advice is I recommend that the families take copies of documents, or better yet, the original documents that identify the children, passports, school IDs, birth certificates, and to put them all in an envelope or a folder and to show the children where they store that. Maybe a drawer in the kitchen, someplace that's readily accessible for the children to find. For if and when somebody shows up to their home to notify them that their parent has been detained by immigration or that something has happened to their parent, the child can just pull this envelope out and hand it over to the police or to the social workers that arrive to the home.
Susan Cruz with Sin Fronteras, that's a nonprofit that serves youth in conflict with the law. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you very much. Likewise.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Erin Miller's grandmother was a WASP, as in Women Air Force Service Pilots, during World War II.
This was a first. They are trailblazers in the military community. They pretty much paved the way for all the following female pilots.
So why can't they be laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery? That story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Here's a question I don't really want to ask, but is this 2008 all over again? Remember 2008? If you've got an IRA, you certainly do. I ask the question because the stock market in China has been tanking, and that's sending shockwaves to markets all around the globe, including here. So what's going on in China? Twice this week, massive sell-offs of Chinese stocks triggered a circuit breaker at the stock exchange there, meant to prevent a free fall. Today, Chinese authorities said they've suspended that mechanism. Let's get some perspective on this from China expert Bill Bishop. He's the author of an influential newsletter about all things China called Cynicism. Is it time to panic yet, Bill?
I don't think it's time to panic here in the U.S. I think certainly there is some panic selling going on in China. To your question, is it 2008 all over again? It is not, and it certainly, even if it were, it wouldn't be being caused by the Chinese stock market. The Chinese stock market is actually, if you want to understand what it is, you pretty much all you need to do is to walk into a casino. The markets in China have never really been related to the economy itself, and the number of participants have been fairly small. The market actually crashed something like 60 to 70% in 2007, and only picked up again about a year and a half ago, and then crashed again last summer. And so I think what's happened over the last couple of days is more a set of policy errors on the Chinese government than sort of something more fundamental going on in China or the global economy.
Well, Americans often look at the Dow Jones as an indicator of how the American economy is doing. Why is it different in China? Why is the Chinese stock market not an accurate indicator of the economy of the People's Republic?
Well, the market's only about 25 years old or so, and it's just never been linked to the – it's never been traded on fundamentals, and it's been a very small part of most individuals' investments. In fact, most people didn't have investments until just a few years ago in China. They don't really have, you know, IRAs or 401ks. People, I think, many people learned after the 2007 crash that and that wasn't the first crash in the history of the Chinese stock market, that the market was basically rigged and it was like a casino. And so even though there was a lot of irrational exuberance from the end of 2000, sort of the third quarter of 2014 into last summer in 2015, where the market more than doubled and then crashed quite precipitously, most people understood that they were basically speculating and that the market was not underpinned by any real fundamentals, and it was more just how quickly can you make money and get out. And unfortunately, a lot of people didn't get out in time, as usually happens.
So is that a sign of just kind of how nascent capitalism in China is, that the stock market or the stock exchange, I guess, is kind of like a game or a casino, as you said?
I think in a lot of ways it is. And one of the things you're seeing with the circuit breaker mechanism that was just introduced at the beginning of this year and then resulted in two of the first four trading days of 2016, the markets closed early, including on Thursday when it closed, I think, after 20-something minutes for the day, is that not only do you have investors who there's not a long history of investing in Chinese stock market, you have policymakers who increasingly are showing that they don't have a clue how to run a market.
You know, one thing we've been hearing for a long time now is that, yes, China's run by the Communist Party, but that the bureaucrats in charge of China's economy have a steady hand on the wheel and they know what they're doing. Have events proven otherwise?
That actually is far more worrisome than the gyrations in the Chinese stock market, because there are a lot of problems in China's economy. And some of those problems, the debt, the slowdown in the economy, issues around the valuation of the China's currency, the renminbi, those are issues that could actually have real impacts on the global economy as opposed to just the stock market. And up until about a year ago, most people would argue, well, you know, they have some of the smartest technocrats in the world. And, you know, yes, they have a lot of problems, but they have very good economic management and they'll get through this. Now, though, I think starting with the way the government actively pumped up a bubble that crashed last summer, and then they had a really horrendously it would be funny if it weren't so serious, horrendously stupid response to trying to save the market. Then they actually started to reset the value of the renminbi and did it in such a terrible way that it cost them, estimates are somewhere around $200 to $300 billion to defend the value of the renminbi. So now, over the last 8 or 9 months, you have to be very seriously questioning the competence of China's economic policymakers. And the question there really is, are these people just they were never that smart, but it was easy pickings for such a long time in China's economy? Or has something else happened? Either the problems are so big that no one can deal with them, or are we seeing now, as you know, I hate to use a Mao expression, but in some ways, politics are in command, not the markets.
Mm-hmm. Bill Bishop, author of the China newsletter, Cynicism. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The plunge in Chinese stocks this week may seem panicky and sudden, but as the world's Jason Margolis reports, the slowdown has been in the works for a while.
Robert Kahn wasn't surprised when China's economy started cooling off. He's a senior fellow for international economics with the Council on Foreign Relations. He says China was roaring at a breakneck pace.
And it's important to remember that China over the last several decades has grown in excess of 10% per year and has accomplished one of the most impressive economic transitions from an emerging market to a major economic power.
But economists knew China's meteoric rise wasn't sustainable.
We also knew that imbalances were building up. A lot of investment maybe was being used poorly. There was too much debt in manufacturing, in real estate and the like.
Kahn says the Chinese government needs to resolve those problems. In the meantime, Chinese investors are fleeing their stock market. But all that money has to go somewhere.
I think what's been most difficult for the Chinese has been where to put it.
That's Martin Schultz, a portfolio manager with the PNC International Equity Fund. He says smaller Chinese investors have turned to safer investments like gold and Chinese real estate.
Historically, it was within China itself. Because particularly the average investor couldn't just take his money and move out of the country.
But increasingly, larger and more affluent Chinese investors have dived into international real estate. Edward Mermelstein is a New York real estate lawyer who works with Chinese institutional investors.
So we're talking about major Chinese institutions, whether it's banks or insurance companies.
He says in the past year, the Chinese investors he works with have more than doubled their stakes in U.S. real estate.
Office buildings, hotels.
As the Chinese economy opens up, individual Chinese investors are also pumping a lot of money into the American housing market. The average price paid by a Chinese buyer for a single-family home last year, $831,000. Most of those deals were in cash. California is the preferred place to buy. Patrick Chovanec is the chief strategist at Silvercrest Asset Management. He says his Chinese clients invest in cities they know, New York, L.A., San Francisco.
It's all about familiarity. When you see Chinese tour groups, very frequently they're the first time traveling outside of China. They move in a pack. And Chinese investors also move in a pack.
Chovanec says as Chinese investors get more sophisticated, though, they'll expand the places where they purchase.
I heard maybe about a year ago that Detroit had become a hot place, and it had to do with that there were some tours being organized for Chinese investors. They go on these trips, and then, you know, it's hot because it's where they are. So it's where they've been taken.
Chinese investors could be taking a lot more American real estate tours. If the Chinese stock market continues to fall, homes in cities like Detroit could increasingly look like a decent investment. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Two men from Yemen arrived in Ghana in West Africa this week. It's probably the first time they set foot in the country, and very likely that they don't speak the local languages or know much about the culture. These two men from Yemen are former Guantanamo prisoners. The U.S. made a deal with Ghana to send them there. But why Ghana? I put that question to friend of the show, Carol Rosenberg. She's with the Miami Herald and has covered Guantanamo for years.
It's a really interesting development. I think it illustrates kind of the ends of the earth that the Obama administration is going to find places for these cleared men to go so they can get out of Gitmo before Obama gets out of the White House.
I know a couple of other African countries have taken Gitmo detainees who've been released, Uganda and Cape Verde. How much do we know about what Ghana gets out of this deal? What are the details of the deal that was struck?
Well, what's interesting about this one is the fellow who went to Uganda was actually Ugandan. And yes, Cape Verde took in some people as an act of humanitarian gesture. And what the Ghana government said was this was part of their humanitarian work. And that's what the Pentagon said as well, that they considered this a humanitarian gesture. What we know is that the foreign ministry said that they will accept these two Yemenis for 2 years. That the U.S. assured them that they weren't involved in terrorist activities, and that after these 2 years, they'll be free to go. And I think what Ghana has done is given us a little bit more of a window into the negotiating that the Department of State has done, which says to us, we're asking foreign countries to take them for just 2 years and then let them figure out where they want to live next if they haven't been properly integrated into society in Ghana.
And is that how it goes? After 2 years, it's Ghana that decides what to do with them?
Well, it would be Ghana that would offer them asylum and theoretically travel documents. So if they give them travel documents, they could leave. Part of the deal is these are Yemeni men who the Obama administration will not allow to go home. They don't currently have any passports or travel documents. So Ghana, in a certain way, will control their fate.
Now, you just said, Carol, that the U.S. Said these two Yemenis were not involved in terrorist activities. That's what they told Ghana. And also, these two Yemenis were apparently cleared for release years ago. So why only now have they been released? What took so long?
There were a couple of problems with these fellows, starting with the fact that they're Yemeni, and both the Obama and the Bush administration had decided that Yemenis couldn't go home. They were also put in a conditional release status, which was something different than plain old transfer, that a 2009 task force said, we don't know that they should just be let go. We want them sent to the custody of another country. And so they were in a little bit of a secondary release status. And I think if we know anything about these guys, they'd spent more than a decade at Guantanamo, and people were concerned about how angry they might be at the Americans for holding them there. Never charged with a crime, never went before a review board, arrived in their 20s, and are leaving in their 30s.
Incredible. Are there any other detainees who are going to be released soon, and where will they go? Is Ghana still interested in more?
I'm not sure we'll see any more go to Ghana, but there are 15 more men who are supposed to be released this month. We know one will go to Kuwait. He's a Kuwaiti, and the Kuwaiti government has said they're sending a plane for him on the weekend. I believe one will probably go to Saudi. He's a Saudi who was cleared for repatriation. And then the other 15, the real question will be, if they're all Yemeni, what countries around the world have agreed to take them? Because really the challenge is to get the Yemenis out.
I always ask you this question, Carol, when we speak, but, you know, Obama has said repeatedly he wants to close down Guantanamo. Are we seeing a kind of a slow drip closure of Guantanamo? Is that what's happening?
The only way Barack Obama closes Guantanamo is by moving 50 or 60 or 70 of the detainees there to the United States. Congress won't allow it. He would have to either defy Congress or get Congress to change its legislation to allow detainees on U.S. soil. You know, earlier this week, I was listening to President Obama talking about gun control, and he said, it won't happen during this Congress. It won't happen during my presidency. I think we'll hear him saying those same words about Guantanamo someday.
Carol Rosenberg is with the Miami Herald and has been covering the Guantanamo story for years. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
Meantime, on the other side of Cuba, we hear reports of lots of people in Havana wearing shirts and even trousers emblazoned with the American flag. Perhaps that's all about the easing of relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Doubtful it signifies Cuban support for the detention center, Guantanamo Bay. Many things in Havana are still recognizable, like the music. I'm talking about that older Buena Vista social club kind of sound. Young music fans in Havana may not be naturally drawn to the old stuff, but some young musicians are, like this band, Acere. The members of Acere love, not just love, they revere the music of their grandparents. And so instead of trying to reinvent the wheel, they decided to simply ride the wheels they got. Here's Acere, courtesy of the fine curators at Putumayo World Music, with a track titled A Favor del Viento, Going with the Wind. Espera que no acaba de una vez y yo sigo arrastrando con mi dolor y hasta la noche larga la paso en vela, bebé, me la paso en vela, bebé, me la paso en vela, bebé, y extrañándote, y extrañándote, y extrañándote, quiero volar a favor del viento para cambiar mi destino, no puedo más con este sufrimiento que hace pedazo mi corazón, quiero volar a favor del viento para cambiar mi destino, no, no, no puedo. Up in a few, can we make a little room at Arlington National Cemetery for women? This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Coming up, the woman who trained many a World War II pilot. But first, the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in southeastern Oregon is getting a lot of attention these days. It's the scene of that standoff between a group of armed men and federal officials. That's a far cry from what you normally see at Malheur.
Some hundreds of thousands of snow geese migrate there every year, all kinds of ducks. It's a wonderful range, too, for antelope, for pronghorn antelope, and quite a lot of elk herds there as well.
That's wildlife photographer Kevin Vang. He and his husband are birders, serious birders. They run a website called Bird Explorers. It's kind of a clearinghouse of information for wildlife enthusiasts around the world.
Wildlife photography has become a huge thing, obviously in the United States and Canada, but also throughout Latin America, throughout Asia, throughout Europe. And, you know, Malheur is one of the key stops for them.
Vang says Malheur is considered an important bird area, or IBA. Lots of visitors from around the globe head to Oregon every year to check it out and spend money.
And Burns, Oregon, I'm sure would be a lot of the money going into that town would come from that tourism, both domestic but also quite a lot of international tourism.
That's just one of the reasons Vang is upset, very upset about the armed takeover of the Malheur Refuge. He recently posted a message online that read, "Warning from the birding community to the terrorists in Oregon, we're watching you." Vang notes that camera-toting wildlife lovers have documented all sorts of bad behavior in national parks and federal lands, things like poaching and illegal traps.
There are people, very good people with very big cameras, who see what's going on. And that stuff does get fed back to the authorities.
And Vang thinks he's got support for that view in the local community in Oregon.
Now that it's sinking in, people are getting very angry, quite frankly. This certainly is about the heritage and the magnificent and beautiful wildlife, but this is also about dollars and cents. These parks need to be preserved and protected and managed in a way that both protects the animals but also brings a lot of value to the surrounding communities.
And if the people who took over the refuge are prepared for a long fight, so too are the birders, says Vang. He writes, "Our years of birding photography have made us endlessly patient and determined." Finally today, we're going to hear from Erin Miller. She describes herself as the proud granddaughter of a World War II pilot, WASP. That stands for Women Air Force Service Pilots. They flew non-combat missions during the war to free up men who were allowed to fly combat. It might surprise you to know that under current rules, those female pilots cannot be laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery. A bill introduced in Congress this week could change that. That's what Erin Miller wants for all the WASPs, including her grandmother, Elaine Harmon, who died last year.
My grandmother was just a generally very adventurous person. Her father was actually a professional baseball player in the 1910s and 1920s here in the United States. He played for the White Sox, the Orioles, all this stuff. So they traveled around a lot when she was small. So I think she was just used to doing kind of adventurous and different things.
Right.
She saw an advertisement for a program to learn how to fly. And she said, "Oh, that sounds like something I'd be interested in doing." I think it was $40 for the whole class to get a license and everything.
Wow.
And she said, "You know, my mom would never have let me do this. So I asked my father," since he was the crazy baseball player adventurer. And he said, "Oh, yeah, that sounds great," and sent her $40. And she signed up and learned how to fly locally at the College Park Airport there in Maryland.
So what kind of missions was she on?
After she was done with her training, she went to Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas. Most of her duties included training the male pilots that were going to go overseas. So she would train them on instrument training. So essentially she would be sitting in the plane and looking around and making sure everything was going fine. And the men would be under the hood. And the purpose was to teach them to fly without being able to see outside of the airplane and only being able to look at their instruments. And so flying the whole plane, just looking at the panel inside the plane. And so her job was basically to make sure they didn't crash the plane. And she also co-piloted the B-17 bomber.
Did you ever speak with her about that? You know, that she was this trained pilot and wasn't allowed to fly combat missions, but she was allowed to teach male pilots to go into battle and potentially die.
My grandmother and the women that she served with, the other WASP, were just really excited to be able to serve their country. You know, they would gladly have gone overseas if they had been allowed to. They had no hesitation at that. They were just very glad to serve their country, and 38 of them did die during their service.
In the early 1940s, how rare was it for a woman to even kind of step up and say, I want to join the WASPs? Was she a pioneer?
It was extremely rare for women to be in the military at all, much less flying airplanes. These were the first women trained to fly military airplanes, so they are trailblazers in the military community. They've pretty much paved the way for all the following female pilots.
You and your family members have this campaign to allow your grandmother's ashes to be buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Explain why this is so important to your family and why she's been denied this honor so far.
Well, my family is from the Washington, D.C. area, so Arlington is, in a way, our local cemetery. We have several family members already buried there, including my great-great-aunt. She served in World War I, actually, in the Navy. Additionally, my grandmother left us a letter stating that it is her final wishes to have her ashes placed at Arlington National Cemetery. And it is important to her because she feels Arlington is not just a military cemetery, but it's also a historic kind of museum, and it showcases different groups of military people and the service they provided. And she feels that the WASP group needs to have representation at Arlington.
I understand that Ashes of Wasps had been allowed at Arlington until last year, but then Defense Secretary John McHugh rescinded those privileges. What was the reason?
We've kind of had to discern that it's something to do with space, but honestly, we're not asking for in-ground burial, which is more of a concern. We're asking for inurnment in the wall. So, and they recently, a couple years ago, built several new spaces for ashes to be placed. So we really don't feel that it's a space issue is a good reason for them to deny this.
When you tell younger members of your family about your grandmother's service with the WASPs, what will you tell your grandchildren?
I tell people that my grandmother was very adventurous. She encouraged all of her grandchildren to go out and follow their dreams and pursue everything because she loved the United States. She said this was the greatest country in the world, and she was very proud to live here. She had an American flag on her front porch every single day of her life. On the 4th of July, she lined her entire driveway with tiny little American flags. I mean, she was like the most patriotic person I've ever met. So she would be extremely disappointed to learn that this decision has been made because she would feel like her country has betrayed her.
Erin Miller is the granddaughter of World War II WASP pilot Elaine Harmon. Thank you very much and good luck with the campaign.
Thank you very much for your interest in our story.
And that's all from us today. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow right here from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston.
PRI, Public Radio International.